Scripture reading is going to be from Isaiah 11, verses 1 through 10. Isaiah 11, verses 1 through 10. There shall come forth a rod from the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. The Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. His delight is in the fear of the Lord, and he shall not judge by the sight of his eyes, nor decide by the hearing of his ears. For with the righteousness he shall judge the poor, and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. He shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall slay the wicked. Righteousness shall be on the belt of his loins, and faithfulness the belt of his waist. The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the young goat, the calf and the young lion and the fatling together. And a little child shall lead them, the cow and the bear shall graze, the young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox, the nursing child shall play by the cobra's hole, and the weaned child shall put his hand in the viper's den. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord, as the waters cover the sea. And in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, who shall stand as a banner to the people, for the Gentiles shall seek him, and his resting place shall be glorious.
There are a few new faces in the audience this morning, and we appreciate your presence. Jill kind of stole all my talking points. You know, you are honored guests, and we appreciate your presence. We hope to be edifying to you. We do design, you know, the worship, so you'll have maximum benefit when you do come to God. We've tried to structure it to be exactly like they did it in the first century. And we know that worked in the first century, so it doesn't seem like we need to alter it in any way. God's wisdom prevails throughout the ages. And this is what we want to do, is impart to you from God's wisdom. We're in a study of the Old Testament at the moment, to show you all the things that have gone on, and I hope some of the things we've related in this series have been impressive to you and you've learned something new. As we proceed on, we're going to be in the fourth of a five-part series on the suffering servant. And I've broken down this particular context, which is the last part of Isaiah 52 and the first part of Isaiah 53, and we'll finish off 53 next week. But I've broken down into the deeply humiliated and greatly exalted. That's the position of the suffering servant, what he's going to go through. And then the fact that he's totally misunderstood because of his seeming insignificance, which he's going to override and prevail in the end. This is the fourth and the greatest of the songs of the suffering servant. That's what we've done, is have gone back, gone through Isaiah 42, 49, and 50, which are also psalms or poems of the suffering servant. Most people leave those off, but it adds a lot to our insight as to what he was facing, what he was appointed to do, and Psalms 53 just being what he had to suffer. The song itself, and there is some things we miss in the English. In Hebrew, it marks certain patterns that you find elsewhere in the Psalms. This song is plaintive and even sorrowful, the style broken, sobbing, and recurrent, yet it is a song of triumph. The light in the poem is very bright, thus the shadows that come out of it are very dark. And this is sensed, if not actually read into it. It is both a poem of lament and also of praise. The song is... nowhere in it does the servant speak. In some of the former ones we looked at, the servant does come forth and ask questions and whatever. But here, he is the object of discussion and haunts, the whole topic of it. One unique feature that stands out most prominently is the fact that the author delights to devise certain basic themes, and he stresses these, he comes back to them for emphasis. Things like the vicarious suffering, the total obedience. We kind of looked at those in the past. The utter willingness to suffer, the guilt of the people of God, and the divine approval of the servant himself. That is, God's got a lot, you know, the Father has a lot to say complimentary about the servant and what he's accomplished and what he's trying to do. Another marked feature is that the song bears no traces of the environment from which it sprang. The material did not come from the prophet's mind, or was it a result from meditation over great theological issues. The only tenable answer is that it is divinely imparted. It is a spiritual insight, especially when it deals with the concept of vicarious sacrifice. We mentioned it already, vicarious, if you're not familiar with the term. Sometimes, well, what we do in movies, we try to, you know, we live vicariously through the characters in a film. You know, when you go through an action film, a lot of times, you know, what the character does is nothing what we would do. But you kind of get into it, and you kind of feel what he does, you know, and you kind of get motivated. But with Christ, you know, as a sacrifice, it was vicarious. That is, it was a substitution. He was doing what we were supposed to. So you need to get a certain sense out of this, especially as we move into the last part next week, of all that he goes through. You were meant to go through that. All of us were. So you have to stop and think, what do I owe him? Because he took my place. One last aspect for the poem is a certain timelessness about the issues discussed. As far as God is concerned, they're already realized. They're a done deal. I mean, as you look at the tenses, it looks like, you know, it's already been accomplished. But historically, it's still 700 years into the future. I mean, this is why we identify these things as the Word of God, because the prophecies that come out, you know, are very exacting. In fact, as you go to and read about the life of Christ in the New Testament, you see just how exacting these prophecies are, down to the minutest detail, and all focusing on the life of one individual. Yet certain factors, you know, as you were looking at, are still to be accomplished. So as far as prophecy is concerned, if God is saying it, in fact, as you get into Isaiah 45, when he talks about Cyrus, he says, ask me about the future, and you'll commit me to the work of my hands. Now, this kind of wipes out a misconception. A lot of people think of the future as kind of like celluloid, you know, movie frames, and that people can look ahead and see, you know, a couple of frames ahead, say, oh, this is what the future holds. You know, that certain mediums can do that, or, you know, prophets or whatever. But that's not the way it works. The reason why God can predict and be accurate every 100% of the time is that if he tells you something is going to happen, now this is where it really gets incredible. It doesn't matter what man does. He's still left a free will, free moral agent. Man, all men, can make whatever decisions they want. And they can make decisions that are counter to one another. It doesn't matter. When God says something's going to happen, he will make it happen. He says, you'll commit me to the work of my hands. And this is, you know, the future is not there. It's a white slate. But if God pinpoints something in it, even gives you a time frame, that means he's going to make it happen. That's why he's so sure about it. This is how powerful he is. Not just being able to see the future, but to make it. And that's what we have to understand about a lot of this. Still, the song remains one of the grandest and most dearly beloved passages of sacred writ. And the church has always construed the passages in a messianic sense, and we'll bring out, you know, one of the reasons why. First of all, in Isaiah 52, we're just reading the last three verses, and we encourage you to read along with us, look at the context. As we said before, then, after we read this, we're going through it either line by line or even word by word, if there's significance to that, and trying to work it out for you. So you might want to look in your Bible, see if there's a slightly different translation or something like that. You can still keep up with it. This is the New American Standard. It says, "Behold, my servant will prosper. He will be high and lifted up and greatly exalted. Just as many were astonished at you, my people, so his appearance was marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. Thus he will sprinkle many nations. Kings will shut their mouths on account of him. For what had not been told them, they will see. And what they had not heard, they will understand." Now these three passages contain in capsule form what is to unfold in the next chapter. So it's kind of a preview. The thoughts are in reverse order. So here success is stressed first, then the lack of it. And then in 53 it's going to flip. We're going to look at the lack of success at first in the crucifixion and all that, and then the crowning achievement, the exaltation. Here God the Father is speaking, and he is asserting that appearances to the contrary, his servant will achieve what he sets out to do. This is something we've been stressing and viewing from the other psalms or the other poems, is that what Jesus was given, the suffering servant, and we'll show you how we identify with him, he was a person. Okay, you might want to think of this. We have a tendency to think of it, well, he's the Son of God. Well, yeah, but he was also someone just like us. And he was given a task no man had ever been given. Now, former prophets had gone and talked to the nation and perhaps other nations, and the apostles were sent into the world, but no one was going to have to do what he did. I mean, if you had been given this task, you would have gone, "You've got to be kidding me. There's no way I can accomplish that." So as an individual, when you think of this, first of all, there's a deep trust in God, that God is going to be with him and help him accomplish this thing that is really beyond the imagination of any man. And two, what we learned last week is that he seems to be listening to God every day. Every day is different. Every task is different. Every challenge is different. But he sits there and listens to God. And like he says in the New Testament, he doesn't speak on his own initiative. What he hears, he speaks. And what he's told to do, he does. And the Spirit is the same way. And it kind of gives us an example, to even the apostles, of how to proceed. Our life is exactly the same way. We should be praying to God every day, as Jesus did. Maybe spend some long hours at night, in prayer. We should be reading the Scriptures and listening to what God has to say to us, to look for the direction he gives us every day. If we are going to be Christ-like Christians, he's given this perfect example to us. And we see this set up for us in Isaiah. Now the verb could be translated, "He will deal prudently." King James Version puts it that way. But the stress lies on the results of the prudent dealing. Or the success, thus, "He will prosper," is the way it's translated here in the New American Standard. And especially, the superlatives that go along in the verse. The degree of success appears in the verbs, be high, lifted up, greatly exalted. So God thus grades the work of the Son. He goes, okay, in fact, isn't that what he did in the first century? At the baptism, "Here is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased." Starting off the ministry, it starts off good. I really appreciate what he's doing, but the task he's taken in hand. When he gets to the Mount of Transfiguration, okay, again, "This is my beloved Son, whom I'm well pleased. Hear him, all of you." The sentence structure now becomes somewhat involved. In fact, the first line of verse 14 is followed by the first line of verse 15. So if you want a continuous thought, read the first line of 14 and then skip down to 15 and you've got the complete thought. The verses in between are parenthetical. In fact, they don't use parentheses, but you notice, you know, at least in this version, there was dashes. That's usually an indication of a diversion or digression. And then it comes back. The two lines, we said, are parenthetical. Thus, the assessment of the situation is that many were astonished or awestruck at it. Then the translators look for a word in contrast. I mean, first of all, he's doing these miracles. And you know, I love the comment about the one man before the Sanhedrin who was cured. And they're questioning, you know, you really think this guy's the Messiah? And his one question is, if he's not and a Messiah does come, is he going to do more than this guy? Could anybody do more than Jesus did? I mean, from sun up to sundown and past sundown, sometimes laboring into the night, you know, he's teaching, he's curing people, you know, he's healing, he's casting out demons. You know, he's impressive. And then for some reason, with the pressure on, it begins to fade in the minds of the people. Older versions use the word like this one says, sprinkle the nations. This is not really a contrast, so a new root is found in some of the newer translations, and they put in the word startle, but we really don't know what the implication is. It's kind of dubious as a translation. But it is going to be impressive. You know, what it's telling us is he starts out good, and then he seems to lag in the polls. You know, we put that modern jargon in there. But then something happens, and kings are left speechless. In fact, they pick up the word startle from the Septuagint, which was a Greek translation of the Old Testament. The parenthetical lines indicate that when the servant was brought low, it was something physical, not just humiliation. So it was in all parts. And that he was bodily disfigured, badly mutilated to the point of being repulsive. So we see the degree prophesied of how bad the persecution is going to be on him. Now, there's something that the Hebrew kind of goes this direction. And it kind of clears up sometimes, you know, what I've heard people say, well, that Jesus was just an ugly person and nobody wanted anything to do with him. No, he wasn't. You know, he might not have been the most gorgeous kid in the town, but he wasn't ugly either. What it's talking about is what's going to be done to him. If you notice, you know, when he starts his ministry, he's not repelling people. I mean, they flock to him. So there's nothing really about his physical appearance that turned people off or repel them. What the Sanhedrin is going to do, what the Jewish ruler is going to do to him, with the help of the Romans, that's going to be repulsive. Okay. But to start off with, in fact, he was probably maybe even a striking individual in some ways. He was carpenter's son. Carpentry back then also included masonry. Some scholars speculate that he was working with his dad on the summer palace of Herod in Caesarea. So you got an individual that's carrying large beams, large stones, whatever. He probably had some pretty good arms on him. I mean, there's no indication when he drove the money changers out of the temple that there was anything miraculous about it. Yeah, perhaps his physique coupled with his zeal just kind of, you know, struck him as it's a good idea to get out of, you know, the precincts at the time. So we're not going to say that he's an ugly individual, but it's going to happen. And there's a parallel that's run here, too, that Isaiah picks up when he talks about, you know, talking about my people. Before, remember, he gets called Israel because he is going to do what the nation couldn't. And so now he's going to be termed Israel. And if you follow the parallel of the nation, It came up from a meager beginning, and that's what we're going to get into with the Lord and with Israel itself. Meager beginnings. This is why, you know, perhaps they didn't pay much attention to him at first. But Israel was made glorious by God. And we'll see this in the life of Christ. But then where Israel fell off, Jesus is going to take it up and finish the work. The amazement of the nations will be over the happy turn of events for the better in the work of the servant. He was brought low and then greatly exalted. You know, that's where this passage leaves off, or this context. And he was. You know, he was brought low through the trials, you know, the abuse, the crucifixion, but then turned into something that even impressed kings. You know, we'll get into that. For example, kings who normally speak their mind on everything, they rule countries, you know, they just feel that their opinion is sought in every situation. Doesn't matter if they've been trained in it or not, they always have an opinion. But they found themselves inadequate to comment on what had happened to him. That, you know, with the turn of a resurrection and a movement they thought was put down and put to rest, suddenly coming on fire and more active and powerful than before. You know, what's going on here? You know, it left everybody speechless. Yet what they had seen had never been told to them. The nations were left a little bit in the dark about what was going to transpire in Israel. You know, the Israelites knew, but seemed to disregard it, even his own people. And then Isaiah brings that up too. What they had not heard, they would now come to understand, as the apostles would appear, you know, before kings, you know, and rulers. Never was a man brought so low and then raised so high. This is a divine conundrum that calls for further elucidation, and that's what follows. Isaiah 53, to explain, you know, this marvel that took place. 53, 1 through 3, and then the lesson will be yours. Where Isaiah, who has believed our message? In fact, this is taken up in Romans, the 10th chapter, about verse 17, you know, what if 15? Who has believed our message? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him. Christ, grew up before him, the Father, like a tender shoot. And like a root out of parched ground, he has no stately form or majesty that we should look upon him, nor appearance that we should be attracted to him. He was despised and forsaken by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and like one from whom men would hide their face, he was despised, and we did not esteem him. Again, you get this, well, is that what his natural appearance was? No, that's what happened to him. A different speaker is now heard from as this chapter starts. It's not the Father, as in the closing of the other chapter. Of all the suggestions as to who it is, the most likely seems to be the believing part of the nation of Israel. And you give an example here of Luke 24:13 of the disciples that the Lord appears to on the road to Emmaus. You know, they're... You know, Jesus told them about the crucifixion. They didn't want to believe it. He told them about the resurrection. So the crucifixion occurred. And they can't, it's still, there's a problem here. You know, they can't get it in their minds as to what's working in out here. And even as the Lord appears to them, they don't recognize who he is. It's not until he does something to their brains that they suddenly realize, you know, everything he told them, everything they'd seen had been prophesied, they knew about it, and whatever. In regard to the remarkable figure in their midst, who believed what reliable witnesses told of him? Like the women of the resurrection. I mean, they've seen the resurrection. The Lord's not in the tomb anymore. And they go and tell the disciples. The disciples don't believe them. They don't believe them until Peter tells them that their Lord has been resurrected. Especially as it came to divine sonship. I mean, how many things did he have to do to prove, you know, even on earth, he was the Son of God. He forgave sins. The second question drives home the point more strongly that God was at work in employing his divine strength of arm in the miracles. They saw God working through Jesus. You know, he was doing things nobody had ever done. You know, other resurrections taking place. Demons cast out. Just, you know, every single kind of sickness, you know, was cured. Plus, a wisdom in the language that was used that confounded both pagan and Jewish scholars and lawyers. Then, and this is the context, it seems they marvel as they reflect on their own blindness. All this he did before them, and they didn't get the right clues until afterwards. And then suddenly, oh, wow. You know, he was Emmanuel. He was God walking among us. They reflect on what little clues they had from the beginning. Growing up, who took particular note of him except his mother? You know, she treasured everything that the angels told her. But there's an interesting example. How many vacant lots do you walk by? You know, as you go someplace or drive by, and you see little, maybe pieces of cactus or the beginning of a tumbleweed or something like that growing, and it's the most insignificant thing in this desert. It says he was like that. They took no note of him. Why? Because, well, he was from Nazareth. As one person put it, what good thing has ever come out of Nazareth? Yeah. So a little tiny village, not noted for, either prophets or whatever, although I think Jonah came from Nazareth. It wasn't a center of learning. No temples there or anything. Maybe a synagogue. But he was like an insignificant shoot of vegetation growing up, unattended lot, probably doomed to wither because of lack of attention. You know, he wasn't only by the age of 12 when his parents find him sitting in the temple asking hard questions of the priests. Yet this term points to the Messiah. This is what Mike read in Isaiah 11, 1 through 10. It was already something they should know. He's described as a young shoot, the root of Jesse, growing. They had indications, they just didn't connect the dots. He was a product of little Nazareth, no rank or majesty of station like he would expect a ruler. His tormentors beat what form was in him. There was no indication that he was ugly in his youth. It was just that people think of men like, why was Saul picked as king? Their first king, because he was a heads above everybody else. He was tall. He was very good looking. And people look at that and go, hey, this guy is a natural ruler. Okay, Jesus wasn't like that. Humble beginning, not taller than everybody else, or strikingly good looking. But there was something there. As in David. When the servant was on trial, no one thought of him worthy of defense. No one came to his rescue. Even his closest disciples withdrew, scattered like sheep. No one considered him appropriate as a deliverer. They went off deciding to look elsewhere. It was not just a case of being unimpressed, but also a matter of being repelled and despised, forsaken. I mean, once the Romans got done with him, they didn't even want to look at him. He was that disfigured. And we're going to look at that in the last part of this chapter. I want you to think about something, and we get to it. We think about, okay, here's our sins, and he died on the cross, and they were forgiven because of the cross. But there's one line that got me started in this whole study. When it says, by his stripes we are healed. Not just the crucifixion. There was something, all that other stuff he had to go through, the humiliation, the spitting, the stripes, all of it was necessary for us. Why? How? Think on that, and we'll address it next week. But this rejection was universal since the nation rejected him. The last is cast in terms proverbial. A man weighed down by sorrow and acquainted with grief. We sing the song, Man of Sorrows, what a name, yeah. That's caught on from the King James Version. The word sorrows there means a man of pains. All sorts of pains, humiliation, disgrace, physical, mental, whatever. The expression tries to cover the most extreme form of the misunderstanding that prevailed. That is, they totally rejected him. But in reality, he was everything but that. He should have received total acceptance. The last line is an emphasis by repetition and points to him at the lowest point. Compare with Isaiah 49:7, which we already looked at. The reality is taken up in the next context. It shows what he worked through for man's sake up to his glorious exaltation. Okay, so that's what we're concentrating on next week. For right now, we've mentioned that this has been accepted as a messianic verse. All right, that is pointing to the Messiah from the very beginning of the church. And why did they do that? Well, for one passage that we have in Acts, when Philip was directed to approach the chariot of the Ethiopian treasurer, the Ethiopian treasurer was reading from this context. And Philip asked him, you understand what you're reading? And the treasurer goes, how can I let somebody teach me? And who is he talking about? Is he talking about, is the prophet talking about himself or somebody else? Then it says, from that passage, Philip began to preach to him Jesus. So we know everything we've said about this context is messianic, specifically pointing to one individual. Again, that individual was Jesus. He was the Son of God, but he was also a man like us. And we need to remember that. He wasn't above the pain. He suffered the pain to the extreme. The humiliation, the degradation, whatever. He felt the stripes. Which kind of gets us into the song we're about to sing. As our invitation, what does all this mean to us? Do we let it slide like the Jews did? Do we not recognize all that Jesus was and what he did for us? Do we just go off on our lives, have more important things to do than to consider this the most important event in the whole history of the world? If Christ hadn't come, if Christ hadn't brought the word, if Christ hadn't died for us, we'd all be, as Paul references the Gentiles, or the Ephesians of the time, Ephesians 2, you were all dead in your trespasses and sins, in which you all formerly walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, and were by nature children of wrath. That's God's wrath. We would all be subject to the wrath of God and have no hope in the future, or even in this life now. No hope at all whatsoever. All the things you do in this life, all your efforts, all your tasks, would be absolutely meaningless. The children that you raise would be all doomed to die and into judgment. In your own life you live, no matter how good you were, or thought you were, or how bad you were, it's all the same without the sacrifice of our Lord. When we die, we're going to stand in judgment. And the song asks us to put ourselves in that situation right now. As you stand before your Lord, and if, like the disciples, you may be able to see the marks on his body. And the question he's going to ask you is, I gave my life for you. I suffered all of this. You've read about it. You've seen it. What have you done for me? Good question. As you look at your life, what have you done for God? The Father gave His Son. Have any of you done that for God? Given your children to Him? You know, try to teach them. Try to bring them upright. Have you given yourself to God? Presented your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and acceptable to Him? Hopefully, you're going to have the right answer when you stand before your Lord. But it's something to think about if you haven't done any of that, or you've only given it meager effort. When Jesus asks you, what have you done for me? Because what He's going to offer to you is, I gave up everything. Not only this life, but heaven itself, so that you could have an opportunity for heaven. If there's anything we can do to make your answer to your Lord something more substantial, please let us know as we stand to sing.